This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly sponsored by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. As a City supporter, we know you value delivery, and McDelivery is up there with the very best. You'll always be winning with McDelivery because just like Kevin De Bruyne, McDelivery puts your order right on a plate. So the only thing left to say is, are you in? Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered as well. So that ordering today means some tasty rewards for you tomorrow. Only via the app at participating restaurants. 18 plus, rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. An FA Cup weekend filled with own goals, red cards, penalties, extra time drama and all-round madness escaped City in the end. It was a double deflection delight for the Blues as they book another Wembley trip for a semi-final tie against Chelsea. It's Monday, the 18th of March. I'm Amos Murphy.
I'm Andrew Denver.
And this is the City Report Podcast.
It's here for Gundogan! It is a thrilling start for Manchester City. The fastest ever goal in an FA Cup final. 2023 is the City treble year. And now, at last, champions of Europe. Manchester City are kings of Europe. Now they have their triple crown.
Welcome back to the City Report Podcast for the start of another wonderful new week, another City victory and another trip to Wembley in the bag. I mentioned double deflection delight. Well, we've got double delight today. Amos and Andrew taking you through the weekend review. And I want to do something a little bit different compared to our usual setup. Obviously, this is a City podcast and we'll speak plenty about the FA Cup quarterfinal against Newcastle. But it was such a bonkers weekend of action. City's game, literally the only one that didn't involve some kind of madness. I'm sure most listeners would have seen or watched at the time, but just to recap, Wolves 2, Coventry City 3, Coventry equalising in the 97th minute and winning that game in the 100th. Chelsea 4, Leicester City 2, Chelsea 2-0 up, 2-2, then a truly remarkable own goal from Chelsea, and obviously United Liverpool, the main event in the evening, serving up some absolutely wonderful Sunday night drama. Andrew, that was quite the weekend of football.
Yeah, and I think even if you look outside of the FA Cup, I mean, there were matches all over. You know, the Burnley-Brentford match, I think, was an excellent one as well. We were talking yesterday about all the bonkers stuff that was happening in MLS. You know, six matches there had red cards, multiple. Like, I watched so much chaotic, wonderful, inject it straight into my veins football this weekend. But it was kind of nice that, for the most part, City's was not that. And frankly, like,
it's weird, isn't it? It was the only game there that was normal.
Yeah, and it's kind of, if you ask fans, and I think this is something that is interesting to think about from the perspective of when people say, oh, watching City is boring, or City are a boring team and, you know, no one wants to watch them. It's largely because Pep Guardiola keeps control of matches. And so that even if City are playing wonderful football, there aren't these swings of momentum. And I've noticed that when you hear people who aren't City or Liverpool fans talking about, oh, City just always win the title. And I'm like, have you paid attention to the title races? Like, those are like incredibly tense and both teams are, you know, putting up perfect kind of performances. And the response always is, oh, well, you know, City were top 8 weeks out and they remained top the whole way through. It's like, well, sure, but that just because there isn't necessarily a change in who's in first doesn't mean there wasn't really a race. But what neutrals want, as we can all attest to City fans kind of talking about the action overall, we want to see the back and forth, the crazy swings of momentum, the chaos. Like, that is, as a neutral, what you want to see. And so I can be empathetic to, you know, someone who watches City routinely win and do so in like 2-0s, where there aren't necessarily lots of moments of chaos or momentum shifts. But yeah, it was, I mean, that might be the craziest FA Cup quarterfinal round I can think of, particularly when, you know, Coventry is one of the teams and you would think, oh, well, they're not probably going to have much of a, you know, chance. And here they are in the semifinals.
Yeah, there was a wonderful period between Saturday afternoon and Sunday dinner time, where dinner time being the afternoon fixture, by the way, send your grievances elsewhere, but where Leicester City and Coventry could have met each other at Wembley on consecutive days, because they could both qualify for the Championship playoff final, and they could have, before Leicester obviously got knocked out, been in the FA Cup final, which are meant to be played on, I think one of them's a Saturday, one of them's a Sunday, or something like that, which would have been absolutely astonishing. But you're right, you know, there is an analysis to take from the absolute batshit craziness of the FA Cup, and I think some teams do take the handbrake off a little bit and say, you know, let's go for it. I think United possibly had it to their advantage and disadvantage at times with that approach. But City, you know, in fact, quite weirdly, actually, and we'll lean into the game now, probably in terms of isolation this season, an uncharacteristic performance. And obviously there's plenty of reasons we've discussed because of that. But the game against Newcastle just felt comfortable. And I don't think I'm right in saying that's been the case for, well, any game this season, really. I remember a couple of weeks ago I asked for just one fixture where City were as good as they were in the first half, in the second half. We might have just got it.
I think that's probably true. There's maybe some individual appearances against weaker opposition where I think that could also be the case, but I wouldn't necessarily hold that up as a great example. You know, and as weak as Newcastle is at the moment, just given the makeup of their squad and their injury list. And, you know, it has not been a vintage kind of sequel to last season for Eddie Howe and his boys, not necessarily, I think, through anything that you can necessarily control or predict. I mean, losing Harvey Barnes and Tonali, and obviously Tonali's is a little different, but it does change things. You know, they're not as good as they could have been, but they're still a very good team. And so I think this was a good sign. And it's kind of similar to last season's timing of when things started to get serious in pursuit of the treble and we started to see City take control. For me, that match is the blueprint for the most part. I do think, you know, with Jack Grealish back in training, if he is there, I would take this lineup and just, you know, other than defense, which I think everyone would understand I'm not talking about, but if we rolled out Rodri, Kovacic, Foden, Silva, Grealish, Haaland, and then, you know, KDB, Foden and Silva kind of rotate in and out, like, I would be very happy with that setup for the rest of the season, because to me, that is the type of setup that does see us have this control across both halves of a match.
What did you make of Newcastle's approach? Because they are one of many teams at the moment hamstrung by injuries quite badly. So even though they've got a couple of players coming back, and obviously Anthony Gordon, who some reports saying he was, and I think this was completely unsubstantiated in the week, saying he's going to be out for 6 months, gets named in the England squad and then obviously starts against City, which I found quite funny. But, you know, they've had quite some considerable players missing, and I don't know, it was just a bit standoffish. But at the same time, when I think back, City didn't particularly have that many chances. Both goals come from deflections, as we've mentioned, and kind of the luck City haven't been getting this year. In fact, they're the goals City have been conceding, which is, again, quite funny. But I don't know. It just felt like there was maybe an opportunity, a window of opportunity for Newcastle to go for it, whether or not that was City just completely shutting them down or not. I felt like it was a bit passive.
I get what you mean. I do think some of this requires some context with not just, oh, they have a lot of injuries, but the injuries they do have. And I think the most important one of those is Nick Pope. They mentioned this on the US broadcast during the match, but it was something I hadn't really thought of. Eddie Howe wants to play, and I think their midfield still tries to play this way, and they were at times playing this way, very on the front foot, very, you know, kind of high pressing. The problem is that when Dubravka is in net as opposed to Nick Pope, Dubravka does not come off his line and play that sweeper keeper role anywhere near the same way that Nick Pope does. And so the defense has to drop more, which means that you do get these weird gaps opening up in Newcastle's setup. And that happened multiple times yesterday, or not yesterday, 2 days ago, when you've got a, you know, opportunity maybe for Newcastle to spring, but they can't really take advantage of it because there's just too big of a gap between the defense and midfield to kind of really spring someone. They still had, I think, some, you know, decent moments that could have turned into something, but City's defense, you know, even though this is probably a quote unquote B team defense, I think handled it quite well. Akanji in particular to me snuffed out a couple of moments of danger that he just kind of simply got the right place, the right time, and took the ball off. And that was the end of the counter. And so that was reassuring to see, because other than Crystal Palace, we've given up the most counter attacking goals in the league. And so I am always happy when we don't really see opportunities like that crop up.
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the beneficiaries of that was Mr. Jeremy Doku, who, let me see if I can make an outlandish statement, possibly his best performance in a City shirt. In terms of overall complete 90 minutes. I know some people hark back to that game against Liverpool at the Etihad Stadium when did he complete a historic amount of dribbles or something like that. And I guess in a similar way to the Newcastle game, there was on the day against Liverpool a sheer lack of end product. And that's probably the biggest question marks around him at the moment, although you hope anyway it will come. But just the way he was interchanging with players, the positions he was picking up on the pitch, he obviously had a little bit more space to work in, which is been his kryptonite in a sense, I guess, but I don't know. It just felt a little bit more complete from him as opposed to the rashness we've seen in recent weeks.
Yeah, I think that's entirely true. I think I would agree that this was his best performance, because I think I know I'm someone who, when I look at a player's performance and I'm analyzing it, goals and assists, if you get them, great. But I'm going to look at what did they come from and, you know, the actual performance. And it's the same thing with a team. You can win a match and play terribly. You know, City drew a match that we probably deserved to lose last week. And just because it was a good point doesn't mean it was a good performance. And I think a lot of times when people look at players, particularly someone like Doku, who is such a, when he is at his best, an aesthetically pleasing player, because he does things that pop on camera, you can get carried away with what the performance was. And, you know, yeah, he destroyed Bournemouth kind of single-handedly, but it was a fine performance, but it wasn't of a level consistently where you're like, that was a really good performance. I think Liverpool performance, similarly, there were good moments. I don't think that he was as deserving of the plaudits coming out of that match as was. I think he's very deserving of plaudits. You know, Bernardo was getting a lot of praise because he picks up two deflected goals. Phil Foden, I think, won man of the match. I think Doku had as good of a game as those two did. Again, his end product still is a little iffy, but that's okay. He's young. He's raw. I'm okay with that. But this performance showed much better decision-making outside of the final third, which we have not necessarily seen from him. And that has, for me, been the biggest issue. It's not, he's not creating perfect passes or he's not scoring. It's he's making really bad decisions in really dangerous parts of the pitch.
I guess the question is consistency, which is the most difficult thing to deliver in football, and you're not going to throw shade at a player for not necessarily being able to do it at, 21 years old, week in, week out in a Guardiola team. And look, everyone probably would have expected Doku to play less, but if he's in the team under Pep, you're going to have to deliver most weeks. And I think that's kind of where people are. The consensus seems to be coming round a little bit from the initial response to when he joined, which is fair enough. He was new kid on the block, exciting young talent. Now it's a little bit like, okay, there's clearly, dare we say it, raw, which I think you and I maybe caught a little bit of slack for suggesting he was earlier on in the season, but we're seeing that now.
Yeah, and I just, to me, again, I don't get how you can be upset about talking about a player who has the relatively short, you know, senior career that Jeremy Doku has, and has so much talent and ability, and it's so clear that he does, but because he hasn't done, you know, the old adage of, you know, 10,000 hours to create a habit, like, he hasn't played 10,000 hours of football at kind of any level, let alone with Pep Guardiola and this system, to where he's going to make the right decisions every time. And so, yeah, he's raw. That's not, it's not a criticism of, oh, he's not a good player. It's just, he isn't the finished product yet. And, you know, Phil Foden was very raw when he came through, and that's why Pep wasn't playing in the middle. Now we are seeing Pep is putting Phil more in the middle because he has the muscle memory. He has the kind of mental, this is what I do in this position, where he can still be the little bit of a street footballer that he is, and Pep is okay with that, because he only does it when it's not necessarily putting, you know, the other team at risk. And Phil's chance yesterday, you know, I wish he had a little bit better end product on it, but like, that was him improvising in a way that Pep is totally cool with, because it didn't kind of put the team at risk. The problem has, I think, with Doku has been that he has that same desire to improvise, but he sometimes does it in bad positions. And so learning not to do that is important.
It's fine, isn't it, when you're the guy in a Stade Rennes team, when you are the guy, basically, and the ball will come to you 90% of the attacks, and if it breaks down, it breaks down, but you're going to make something happen. But when you're surrounded by the other players who can make stuff happen, and I will say part of the topic for part two is going to be Kovacic and the balance he brings to City's midfield, but that certainly hasn't helped him, the fact that he's been playing essentially as part of a front five with De Bruyne and Foden and Alvarez, you know, all of these attack-minded players whose first thought is to go forward, when sometimes, you know, you do need somebody in there who is going to pass it back and not give it to you all the time, because, you know, that's how City play. I guess we'll leave it there for part one. Still plenty to talk about in part two. Listeners, stick around. We'll see you in a second.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The Etihad Stadium really is wonderful at this time of the season, and the same goes for McDelivery. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. Welcome back to the City Report podcast. First episode of three this week. Obviously, we are in the international break, which is, I can get by international breaks, but the ones in March are absolutely madness to me, considering you've just about got everything ramping up and then suddenly, no. Friendlies against Brazil and Georgia and all sorts of teams. Anyway, let's continue the chat about Newcastle, because I'm sure over the next week or so we'll have plenty of time to lambast international breaks, Andrew. But Rodri and Kovacic, probably the two best performers in terms of a duo. I do agree, sort of Phil Foden and Akanji individually were great, but just those two together, again, having seen it a little bit at Anfield, are just looking sublime.
Yeah, it's, they complement each other really well. And I think it's kind of because they are both in-betweener midfielders. And they, I was listening to the Double Pivot podcast episode that they did on the City-Liverpool match, and it was interesting hearing them talk about Rodri, because they both were not necessarily high on Rodri as the Fernandinho replacement when he first came through. And they talked about it, and, you know, their logic was, you know, Rodri can't do what Fernandinho did, which is very much true. And if you look at the way Rodri plays a six, it is not in any way like how we played with a single pivot six with Fernandinho there. And one of the interesting things is that, and they said basically what City saw was that Rodri has godlike ability with long passing. He attempts an absurd amount of, you know, long passes and completes at like an 85 plus percent rate, which is just insane to do, particularly into the areas that he's putting those passes. But one of the interesting things, too, is that if you look, and it's been a benefit of having Stones take the role that he has and the way we've kind of adapted the defense, but Rodri is kind of getting forward and is involved in the attack as much, or I mean, probably more than any, you know, quote unquote six in the world is. I think he gets like three touches in the opponent's penalty box a match, which is a pretty high amount for the guy that's supposed to be, you know, anchoring your midfield. But Kovacic, similarly, he's an eight, but he is not necessarily like going to be up in the box, like scoring goals. That's not like, he is also kind of, he's an eight in the way that Rodri is a six, in that they can play that role, but like, they're not totally doing what you expect them to do. And I think that just works really well because it kind of means they can kind of both just like move forward when they need to drop back. They seem to have good chemistry. And Kovacic, I mean, yeah, I think we play safer with him on the pitch and we have more control, but like, that dude loves himself a like get the ball, look up, oh hey, there's Haaland or there's, you know, Foden streaking, and I'm gonna try to, you know, hit him on the break. And so I think that's something good to have as well. But again, I think that because we're talking about someone who has played so much senior football, when he does it, he's doing it in the right moments, and so it doesn't cause the control to break down as much, because he's either going to be successful or the ball gets turned over, not in a dangerous area of the pitch.
And I believe I saw the two of them completed more passes than the entire Newcastle 11 plus substitutions, which is, I always love stats like that. And yeah, I guess the overall very simplistic point to take from this is midfielders playing in midfield, because it was a hot topic last week, wasn't it, about Julian Alvarez and him coming in and going into that left wing position and sort of having played in a little bit of a deeper role since Kevin De Bruyne's return. But there's something to be said, and it's, again, very simplistic, but midfielders playing in midfield. And I don't think it's a surprise, especially that second half. We had the most City-like controlled aspects of a game I think we've seen for a while. I'm struggling to remember a period of time where Newcastle had their foot on City's throat, and you know, there may be one or two chances, but it was on the break. That's kind of harking back to this time last year when we started to see City kill out games in that manner. And it's just, I guess, a small point before we move on, but it's just nice to see midfielders in midfield. Fingers crossed it continues.
Yeah, I completely agree. It is something that I think too often we look at players and think, oh, they're a really good player, and we don't think about they're a very good insert this role. You know, in economics, there's something called the Peter Principle, where if you promote someone to too high of a role, they are potentially likely to get promoted past their point of competence. And I think someone like Alvarez, he's an incredibly talented footballer. He, at times this season, has been played past his point of competence and, you know, ends up hurting the team, not through his own, you know, lack of a, or I should say his own, you know, flaws, but it's because he's not designed or built or trained to do what he needs to do in that position. And so, you know, Pep is the most inventive player, or not player, manager that we've probably ever seen. He has basically won, you know, every Premier League title without a real left back, and continues just to not play left backs. And, you know, I think the old adage is it's easier to drop players back than it is move them kind of forward at times. And I think that when it comes to the midfield, I just, yeah, please, for the love of God, Pep, if every game that can be played of Kovacic and Rodri behind our less control-based front line we kind of have right now, please do that, because we're all, like, fans are going to be happier. I think the players are going to be happier. You're going to be happier because the team's going to play well. Like, just, it's everyone's best interests.
The trophy cabinet will probably be happier as well, if this season's been anything to go by. And I think we'll probably pick this up later on in the week, but our very own Joe Ricci made a hot topic, to say the least, suggesting that Kovacic and Rodri should be City sort of go-to pivot for the rest of the season. I don't think that's too hot of a take. But he went on to finish it by saying maybe Kevin De Bruyne drops out of the team to allow that to happen in certain lineups, which, again, we'll come back to that later on in the week, I think, but it's certainly an interesting talking point. Stefan Ortega is an interesting one. And I know the guys did a little bit of chat about him in the aftermath of Edison's injury. And I think we can all agree I speak for you here, Andrew, but I'm sure you'll say the same, that he is comfortably the second best backup goal. The best backup goalkeeper in world football. However, he made a wonderful, absolutely game-changing save. I think it was at 2-0. Maybe Alexander Isak had the opportunity. But I do think we saw the benefit of Edison and sort of the underlying benefit of Edison with a couple of the distribution errors that Ortega made. And it would just be interesting to see if he's still in net for the Arsenal game and slash or possibly Real Madrid in the Champions League, that it could be an issue. We know how high Arsenal like to press. I think Newcastle maybe missed an opportunity or two, because he could have been having a bad day, don't get me wrong, but you do see it, don't you, when Edison isn't there, just how crucial his distribution is. And that isn't a slight on Ortega at all, by the way. He's excellent. It's unrealistic to say he can be up to Edison's standards. But yeah, you get the point.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about Ortega trying to step into the role of probably the best distribution goalkeeper in the history of world football. I mean, he is a freakish ability. There are a couple other people who are close in their passing abilities, but none of them have the accuracy on kind of longer passing that Ederson has. And so expecting Ortega to come in, who he himself is a very good, you know, keeper with the ball at his feet. And it's still crazy to me that he was as available as he was for City. And I think it goes to show that too often clubs get hooked up on the idea of defenders in relegation bound teams. They don't necessarily look at them the way they should, because a lot of times it's not, oh, the defense is bad, it's everything in front of them. But yeah, I mean, he did very, very well. I do think that the save he made, which I don't think is a save that Ederson makes, but
that's an interesting
shot
point, 'cause I agree,
doesn't
as well
happen with Ederson, because Ederson would have claimed that ball. And so yeah, there is kind of this weird interplay of, I think Ortega is better with the ball. Ortega is better at saving shots than Ederson, but Ederson prevents shots that Ortega allows to happen. I'm not saying he is anywhere near this level, but it is a little bit like David De Gea, who made a lot of really like highlight level saves, but usually because he didn't do the thing that the keeper should do to stop the shot from ever taking place.
It is an interesting paradox. And to go back to the point before about whether or not Ortega or Edison will be in goal for these sort of bigger matches coming up. Obviously, we'll know Ortega plays in the FA Cup, which is absolutely fair. It'll be interesting to see against Real Madrid, say Ortega did play, because I think in the Champions League, you could get away with it more. And even though Edison had an unbelievable run in between the sticks for City's Champions League run last year, you are probably going to face a few more shots, and having a better shot stopper, if that's the way you see it, it could be a benefit. I do fear for the Arsenal game, though, if that distribution is similar, and it's still good, like I said, it's not a slight on Ortega, it's still top quality, but it's just the one or two passes every now and again which may stray, and then suddenly you're on the counter-attack, which is, it could be a problem. Andrew, I want to wrap today's episode just reacting to a couple of the draws that we've had over the last couple of days. Take you back to Friday for the the Champions League draw. That seems like a million years away by now. But we spent the build up of that week sort of doing the best case, worst case scenarios. If there's a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being absolute dreamy, City going to walk to the Champions League final yet again, 1 being the hellscape, worst possible case, where do you think City's, first of all, quarterfinal and then potential semi-final draw comes in?
So I think you have to balance two aspects of how the draw came out, which is, first of all, you know, yes, there were some easier teams in the draw, but for the most part, I think, you know, it's City are a bit above, I think, Real Madrid and Arsenal, and then there's a few teams right below them, and then I really think everyone is but Dortmund are like capable of winning some ties. So I don't think it's necessarily ideal from the draw perspective of the teams we ended up on the way to the final. Now, if you make it to the final, and I mean this for Arsenal, Real Madrid, or City, like you kind of have already beat everyone that you are worried that
last year,
quote unquote, can beat you. So that's good. It makes the route there more difficult. But to City's favor, and what we had last season, is that we play at home the second leg both times. And I think that's huge. I think that's I think that's frankly, at this stage, when we are talking about the eight remaining teams in the Champions League, probably more important than who you draw. You know, obviously you want to avoid playing as many good teams as you can, but you can't do that at this stage in the tournament anyways. So I think that's a little bit of a wash, but the way that worked out, I think, is important for City. Obviously really who's home and away for Wembley doesn't matter as much. And frankly, I do think it mattered not getting Arsenal this round, both for the Champions League and the Premier League. I think that matters a lot. And so, look, who knows who we end up facing. I think we should be confident against Real Madrid. I know Cheeky's face did not look particularly enthused when Real Madrid were announced, but I have to imagine Real Madrid didn't love that draw either. And, you know, we'll take care of them.
I think that's the mentality you have to approach this. And I know City fans of a certain vintage, myself included, sort of look at it and go, oh my God, it's Real Madrid. But Real Madrid will be looking at it going, oh my God, it's Manchester City. And they'll still have some scars, whether or not they're able to avenge them at the Etihad Stadium, given the manner of last season's defeat. But I completely wholeheartedly agree with the at home versus being away from home at this stage of the competition. That's a truly big one for City, especially given that side of the draw, because look, I don't know if City are better than Real Madrid this season. We'll see. But it certainly feels like on paper, City have dropped off a little bit. Real Madrid have improved a little bit. Whether or not that's enough to even it out, I don't know. But it is those sort of factors that can be the difference. And I do expect the Etihad to be bouncing a little bit like it was last year. As for the semi-final, again, it possibly turns out to be a quasi-final, a little bit like Real Madrid was last year in the semi-final, if that's making sense. In terms of semi-finals then, City are through to one of them, having beaten Newcastle, like we've just discussed, and Chelsea, the team to come out of that FA Cup draw. Manchester United somehow beating Liverpool and unsurprisingly getting Coventry City, the lowest ranked team left in the competition. But I guess City got Sheffield United last year, so it goes both ways. But again, similar question, where are you feeling with that FA Cup semi-final draw?
You know, we were talking kind of before the draw came out of, would you rather have, you know, United or Chelsea for the semifinal, and like kind of what that means for the final. Just, you know, no disrespect to Coventry, but you aren't expecting whoever draws Coventry of the three teams kind of to not be able to get past them. And so for my money, I, you know, came around to the idea, and Amos, you were the one that pointed this out, of, you know, maybe Chelsea are a slightly better team on paper than United, so you would prefer United in the abstract. The emotions of that being a derby and where it will fall in the season, I do think went out for me of saying, you know, Chelsea. And it's like, look, we did, I have not been enthused with our two Chelsea performances this season, but we kind of also,
lucky, eh?
Yeah, but we also did enough, I think, to win those matches on another day. And so, look, you prefer Coventry every day of the week, but you know, this Chelsea team, like we saw it against Leicester, of just the stupid kind of moronic decisions that some of these players can make. Because again, much like when we talk about Doku, that team is full of players who do not have fully formed like prefrontal cortexes, let alone fully formed like tactical understandings of the game. And so you're going to get really bad.
There's been some takes
on
Chelsea
decisions
this season, but I think that's probably the best that I've seen so far. They don't have a frontal lobe. That's Chelsea's takeaway for this season.
Look, when you play a team entirely of 25 or under 25s, like that's going to happen. But I mean, frankly, the dumbest decision, and I made the joke about it before he took the shot. And then I said, oh, he backed off enough. Sterling's not going to do it. But I said, Sterling's going to put this in the upper tier. And then he did. And it's like truly maybe the worst free kick I've seen taken in a long time. I mean, it just from the run up, you're like, oh, this isn't going to go well. And so I'm confident in City's ability to get past Chelsea. Now, the timing of the fixture, it's not ideal to play a team like Chelsea. And, you know, there could be a whole lot of things change between then and now. But in the abstract, I still think City are the favorites to get past Chelsea, which, you know, unfortunately means that we probably could end up with another Manchester United, Manchester City final, and it's a derby and, you know, not ideal. But, I mean, honestly, I will take that over us having to play Klopp in the FA Cup to potentially prevent this, like, historic, religiously anointed, if you ask some commentators, quadruple, quote-unquote, the quadruple, as many were referring to it on social media, which I hate to tell you this, guys, it's not the quadruple if it's the Europa League. Like, I'm sorry, that doesn't count.
I think I'm just going to sit these shows out. I'm just going to hand you the mic and it's going to be a monologue. Top four, Mr. Detmer. But no, I completely agree. My mental gymnastics was not nearly as funny. But essentially, I was looking at it from the sense of, and you sort of flirted with the mentioning it there, but City will play this FA Cup semi-final probably 4 days after their second leg against Real Madrid, because City play the Real Madrid game on the Wednesday. You'd expect the FA Cup final to be on the Sunday, albeit that could change. And knowing the FA and their scheduling, it would probably be 12:30 on the Saturday. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But basically, I was looking at it going, obviously, Coventry would have been the ideal one. And I think you look back at last season when City had just had Bayern Munich in the Champions League and then played against Sheffield United. They were able to rotate the team. They got through that comfortably. Had that been United or Brighton in that semi-final, I think maybe last season looks a little bit different. We'll never know. But at the same time, when it's United on the table, obviously Liverpool would have been the horrible draw that thankfully don't have to deal with that. But when it's United on the table, first of all, they've got something to avenge considering the way they lost the final last year. Secondly, as we've seen in the past, I think it's an important point that Guardiola has made the FA Cup semis in all but one of his seasons at City and gone on to reach the final just twice. Part of that is because of that Champions League scheduling. And that obviously plays into a fact here. You would expect City's shadow team, though, to at bare minimum put up a fight against Chelsea's best team. And I do think Chelsea have had some unfortunate results. They could have easily won the League Cup final. They've had some dreadful results. They could have easily been knocked out of the FA Cup on more than one occasion this season. But you would expect the shadow team to do the job. So I think I'm probably coming at it from the three possibilities. It's the median, basically. I wouldn't have wanted to face, I can't believe I'm saying this, I would rather have faced United in the final, basically, than the semi-final, just because of the context surrounding that game, which is crazy. And I wonder if maybe the fact that City played United in the final last year is playing a part. Had it not been done before, would I be thinking, oh my God, no, get it out of the way, semi-final. I don't know. But that's where we're coming in.
I think that's a good point, because there's something on top of that, which is that we are potentially going to be playing United in a position, let's say we make it to the final, United make it to the final. Where that match falls is much better for our ability to manage that game than if it is in where it's going to be as a semifinal and we're playing United, because United at this point, like, yeah, they're trying to get to fifth because that is, you know, potential Champions League, but like, it's not fully within their control. They are up and down form, but like, getting up against City, we've seen them do it already this season, and, you know, came pretty close the last time we played them. And so, like, I am fully of the belief that I would rather have fresh legs and not be trying to play a shadow squad against a team that it's like going to treat it like the Super Bowl, which they did to, you know, against Liverpool, of like that's a season defining, you know, game for United in a way that City used to have games that were defining for the season of, we're going to deprive another team that we hate of something rather than we're going to win something. Because United probably don't feel confident of winning the FA Cup if you were to ask them privately, but making sure Liverpool can't win it, like, the fans are going to be happy and, you know, a lot of those players will be happy. And so they will feel the same way about us. So if we can play them where most guys will get a week beforehand of, you know, rest in their legs, I'd rather have that than, you know, trying to play them 3 days after Real Madrid. The one thing you didn't mention is this does move the Spurs match, and likely means that will be the second to final game, Spurs away, which, woohoo.
It could be the final boss of Tottenham away hoodoos, considering we have scored there, albeit not in the Premier League, and then would have to go and win there potentially to either keep alive hopes or possibly even secure the Premier League title. Oh my God, could you imagine if City won the Premier League title at Tottenham? I think.
Well, hey, you know, Spurs deserve to see a team win the title at their beautiful new stadium. So,
oh my God, yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, though, because City are at home on the final game of the season, they wouldn't actually be able to lift it. That would have been even better if City had lifted the title at Tottenham Hotspur. That won't be able to be the case, unfortunately. But I guess the final point: plenty of big games coming up, and I think. I said at the top, international breaks, middle of the running, pain in the arse, you know, just want to keep going. But it's kind of possibly a good time to just breathe in, breathe out, take a sort of moment to sort of prepare for what could be, hopefully, fingers crossed, another sort of club-defining run of fixtures.
Yeah, and I, you know, we haven't seen the treble documentary yet, but we have seen previous documentaries of the run-in and the way that Pep motivates and talks with these teams, and letting these guys get away from this grind for a little bit. And obviously they are, you know, they're still playing football. They're still practicing. Some of them are going to, you know, if they're not on international duty, they are staying at City and going to be, you know, training with the coaching staff still. But when they come back in, you know, let's say about 10 days time, they're going to walk through that door and there's probably going to be a, you know, for lack of a better phrase, come to Jesus meeting with Pep and the squad and say, hey, look, here is what we have in front of us for the next 2 months. And depending on how you handle yourself each and every day, when you wake up, what you eat, the way you approach training, the way you sleep, what you do in these games, every single decision you make for the next 60 days could be club defining and could be career defining for you. And yes, a lot of these players have already won a treble. And so frankly, it's amazing that we are as motivated and well positioned. But some of these players haven't done that. And you know what? Doing a back-to-back treble would be absurd, insane, incredible. And why wouldn't you want to do that if you were a player? And that's a little bit of a facetious question, but like these players know what is at stake. And so when they get back from international break, they're going to sit down and they're going to, you know, put their heads down and this is where the rubber meets the road and we'll see what happens. And just because we don't win another treble doesn't mean it's a failure. But what I do want to see is that these players and this team go out and actually try to get this thing across the goal line again.
Yeah. Hey, let's see. Let's see if that's going to be the case. Hopefully it will. Andrew, though, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Listeners, thank you very much. We'll be back, like I said, another two times this week. International break, reducing the schedule, but we'll have plenty of wonderful episodes, a few extended episodes as well, a little bit like this one, a little bit longer, to have for you later on in the week. So listen out for them. Until next time, though, it's been a wonderful pleasure. We'll see you later. Make sure you're geared up for Man City's end-of-season run-in with McDelivery. Great food delivered right to your door. By using McDelivery, you won't miss a moment of City's crucial run-in, and just like Kevin De Bruyne, they deliver your order exactly where you want it. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. Are you in? At participating restaurants only, 18 and plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.